17 seconds and counting. Guidance internal. 15, 14, 13, 12, 11, 10, 9. We have ignition sequence start. Engines on. 5, 4, 3, 2.
Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are willing to control, and one we intend to win.
Okay, engine stop. ATA at a descent. Flight control mode, auto descent, engine command override off. Engine arm on. 413 is in.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
My guest on Cosmic Perspective Radio is Nobel laureate and senior scientist at Goddard Space Flight Center, Dr. John Mather. Dr. Mather, it's an honor to have you with us today. Thanks for joining us.
Well, happy to join you.
Dr. Mather, I'm sure that many others have asked you the same question. What made you decide to become a scientist?
I don't remember ever deciding. I think I just was one. I remember being really excited about science in fourth grade. So somewhere before that, it must have been the event. I do remember going to visit the Museum of Natural History in New York and seeing the planetarium show and the dinosaur bones and the volcano exhibits and thinking, oh, that is so cool. And now here we are.
Yes, and I live not too far myself from there, and it's a great place. And I've heard many other people tell me the same thing, that their interest was sparked at the Museum of Natural History, a great place for people to go to.
Well, it still is.
Through your work and the work of many others, we now know that the universe is expanding. But how do we measure the expansion, and how do we know the universe is expanding?
Well, what we actually see is that distant galaxies are running away from us very fast, with a speed proportional to distance. Of course, we measure that rate of expansion by the Doppler shift, which is something you can also hear with your own ears when you are out there on the highway and you hear the motorcycle go by you. We have a similar effect for light waves that lets us measure the speed of motion of something toward us or away from us. So what we see is these faraway galaxies are going away. If you divide the distance by the time, you get the same answer for all the galaxies, which is the age of the universe, about. So that's how we know that what we see is there. It was a big surprise. We found it out in 1929 when Edwin Hubble drew us a graph. So what we say is the universe is expanding, what we actually mean is distant galaxies are running away from us. So we are unable to see any local effect of this. As far as we can tell, the solar system is, and the gravity in it are not affected by this great expansion.
The term the Big Bang, people use that today, but I hear you say expansion of the universe. And I also heard that the Big Bang was just something that was given by Hoyle as a mockery to the expansion of the universe theory. Is that correct?
Yes, he gave it that name back in the 1950s on the radio, and it's confused people ever since. When you call something a Big Bang, it feels like a giant firecracker, but it's actually the exact opposite of what astronomers have seen. The firecracker happens at a place and a time, and the universe expanding, it happens everywhere, and there is no first moment. So the universe is expanding into itself, unlike a firecracker, which is expanding into the surrounding area. So it's been a confusing thing for people, but there's no ambiguity in what scientists see. The distant things are running away. And if you imagine running it backwards in your mind to where everything rushes together and condenses into smaller areas, then you say, oh, it must have been really hot and condensed when it was young. So that led to the predictions that we should be able to calculate all kinds of nuclear physics, and also that there should be heat left over from those early moments, and we should be able to go measure it. So that's called the cosmic microwave background radiation, and sure enough, it's there. It was discovered by accident in 1965, then led on to the work that I worked on at NASA.
The universe is expanding. This all started out with hydrogen and helium, and what happened after that?
Well, golly, as far as we know, the hydrogen and helium was all that was left after the first few minutes of the expansion. And what happened then was it just cooled off and cooled off and cooled off and got less and less dense until the gravitational forces were enough to pull this material back together. So there are some places where the early universe was a little more dense than average, and other places were a little less dense. The places where it was just a little more than average, there was enough gravity to stop the material from expanding. So gravity pulled it back in and made it into galaxies and then stars and then eventually planets and people. So gravity did it.
So gravity is the reason why we're all here. I guess we can call ourselves recycled material.
Absolutely. Of course, how did we get recycled? Well, I told you how the gravity pulled the material back in to make stars. We didn't say yet that stars blow up when they're old, or sometimes they just sort of peter out, but many of them blow up, and the products of the nuclear reactions that are happening inside them get redistributed. So something like the Crab Nebula, which blew up on July the 4th of AD 1054, and now we see the remnants expanding, and we can see that they're made out of the chemical elements of life, the ones that the solar system seems to be full of, carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, calcium, iron, phosphorus, all the things that it needs to produce life. Those atoms were released into space by exploding stars and then recycled. So when you look in the mirror in the morning, you are looking at atoms that have been circulated out there into outer space for hundreds of millions of years, maybe more, and then pulled back together again by gravity.
So gravity is the thing that, I guess, was responsible for all of it.
Yeah, gravity is the unique force in all of the forces that we know about, which is always attractive. There is no anti-gravity that we are aware of, so particles are always pulled together. Even antimatter particles are pulled together by gravity. That's a remarkable discovery and one that seems to be responsible for our existence.
I have a question, and I don't know if I'm going to ask this correctly. We now know we have dark matter and dark energy in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the dark matter is responsible for the stars rotating around the centers of galaxies at the same speed, if I remember correctly, or the same time frame. I'm thinking of Einstein's equation, E equals mc squared. Can dark energy become dark matter or convert to dark matter?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. But we don't know what either of them is, so maybe. I think there's always got to be the maybe part. For your listeners, we should say what they are, as far as we know. Mm-hmm. Dark matter is something that seems to behave like particles, seems to have motion, seems to have gravity, but we can't see it because it's actually transparent. So we shouldn't even be calling it dark, we should be calling it transparent. It has enough gravity to influence a lot of things, including the formation of the first galaxies, including the little bumps on the map of the cosmic microwave background radiation, including the way that galaxies rotate. And so that's pretty clear that we have detected its presence, but we can't see it. And the dark energy is a whole other thing. We found out back in 1998 that the universe is not only expanding, but the galaxies are rushing away from us faster and faster. So that means something's doing that, or else it's a feature of the equations of gravity. Einstein put that in his equations of gravity, and so far it seems to be matching his story, although we're unhappy about that because we don't understand it.
From the Hubble Space Telescope and other instruments, we now know that the universe is approximately 13.8 billion years old, I believe.
13.8, yeah.
So we know that the edge of the universe, or what we call the observable universe, is that distance. Do scientists have any idea or hypotheses on what may be beyond the observable universe?
Okay, so we can't see the whole thing at once because the universe does have an age, and that means you can't see anything farther away than the distance that light can travel in that amount of time. However, we have no sign that there's anything different beyond. So our imagination says, well, it's probably much more universe just like our part farther away. So we're only able to see a small area of probably infinite universe. Now, infinite just means no edge. You can keep on going and going and going in your imagination in any direction, even if you can't see it. Some things we have to go at with our imagination and our mathematics because you could never possibly see them. as far as we can tell, there is no hope of seeing past those most distant things, just we don't have time.
I'd like to talk a little bit next about the Cosmic Background Radiation Explorer mission. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about the mission and some of the goals of the mission?
Yeah. So it was proposed in 1974 to go measure the cosmic microwave radiation, this heat that's left over from the early universe, and also to look for the light of the first galaxies. So you might imagine that when the first galaxies lit up, they would fill up the universe with their own radiation, and maybe we'd see some trace of that, even if you could never find the individual objects. The mission was proposed with that in mind, and we finally flew it in 1989, and right away it measured the cosmic heat. We found immediately that the prediction of the expanding universe story was matched exactly by the measurements. The prediction says there's a formula that describes the brightness of radiation versus frequency. It's called the black body formula. And the measurements said, yeah, it's exactly that. All the measurements were exactly on the curve that was predicted. So that was pretty huge sigh of relief for astronomers, because it meant our relatively simple picture of the early universe is probably correct. Our second big discovery was to find out that that cosmic heat has lumps in it, that there are hot and cold spots in those early times that are really quite faint. So the radiation itself is pretty bright, although you can't see it. It's the most intense radiation in the universe. But the little hot and cold spots are really faint compared to that, like 1/10,000th or 1/100,000th of the total. So we're talking about observing micro degrees Kelvin out of a total temperature of 2.7 degrees Kelvin. That was a huge technical accomplishment. And Stephen Hawking saw it, and he said that was the most important scientific discovery of the century, if not of all time. So now we can say why it was important. So number one, those hot and cold spots meant different densities in different places. So the story I told you earlier about gravity stopping the expansion of the dense regions and pulling them back in to make galaxies and stars, well, that's possible because the early universe did have these spots. Second thing, we know most of those spots come from the dark matter that astronomers deduce but can't see. And the third thing is, if we could ever know what made the spots, maybe we'd understand quantum gravity, which is one of the most difficult and challenging questions in physics today. So those were the two first big surprises. Then we got a third surprise, which is all those galaxies we were hunting for that made the universe twice as bright as we ever thought it would be. And nobody had expected that.
These spots that we talked about, these areas that were more dense, does that mean that the universe was expanding at different rates as it expanded?
Well, we got different ways of thinking about it. One is that the expansion is varying. Another one is it's just ordinary gravity working. Anyway, so I think of it as ordinary gravity working on the large scales, and it has a chance to do that, even as the general flow of material is outwards from here, or outwards from everywhere.
So we see these spots in the universe, but also we see that the universe is expanding and kind of running away. Is it expanding faster than we thought it would be?
So yes, we're able to see the effects of this cosmic dark energy now in making the universe accelerate and go faster and faster. So maybe I should say how we found that out. We measure the distance to things based on how bright they are. And in particular, this time we were using something called supernovae, which we understand well enough to use to calculate their distance from the brightness. And it turned out the most distant ones were about 20% fainter than we thought they would be. The upshot is something has changed the relationship between distance and speed. And the answer was, the universe must have been speeding up for the last 5 billion years, even though it was slowing down before that. So that was the discovery of what we call dark energy.
Do some scientists think that the universe will stop expanding and collapse or come back on itself?
Well, currently the favorite idea is that it's going to keep on expanding and going faster and faster. On the other hand, before this acceleration was discovered, we were pretty interested in the possibility that it was bouncing, that it expanded and then contracted and bounced and expanded again and it stopped expanding and contracted. So right now it doesn't look like that, but who knows?
I'd like to talk a little bit about the James Webb Telescope next. The Hubble Space Telescope, as well as the Cosmic Background Radiation Explorer and many other instruments, helped us answer many questions about the universe. What will the James Webb Telescope tell us that the other telescopes could not?
The Webb Telescope is designed to pick up infrared light, so at longer wavelengths than what the Hubble Telescope can see. On the other hand, much shorter than what the cosmic microwave background radiation is. So we're aiming to see the objects out there that are unique in the infrared. So several kinds of them. One is the most distant galaxies. The expansion of the universe stretches out the light waves that we get until they are infrared, and you can't see them anymore with the Hubble, but you can see them with the Webb telescope. That's number one question. What were the first objects that formed in the universe? And the Webb telescope is aimed at that one. Then how did the galaxies grow? They probably grew out of lots of little pieces merging together, and we now have some beautiful computer simulations and theoretical calculations that say that's what we think should have happened, but we got to go look and see if it's true. Third thing we want to do is look inside those dust clouds where stars are being born today. It turns out the infrared light will go around the dust grains and let us see inside, learn how stars are born, along with their planets. And I guess the last big question is, well, what about those planets? Where did they come from? Are any of them likely to be like Earth? And so now that we know that most stars have planets, that's gotten to be a very exciting topic, too.
I'm just kind of wondering about the resolution of the James Webb Telescope. Mm-hmm. What's the smallest area it could resolve compared to the Hubble Space Telescope?
Well, it's a little bit sharper than the Hubble Telescope, but it also works at longer wavelengths, which is the thing that makes it special. Just to give a quantitative number, we have smallest pixels on the camera that are 0.03 arc seconds across. So the best you can do with an ordinary small telescope on the ground is 1 arc second. So this is way, 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 way better.
I see. So the resolution is a little bit better, but the wavelength allows us to see further back?
Yes, further back in time, and also deep into cold regions, dusty regions that are close to home here.
How far back to the beginning of the universe will the James Webb take us?
Well, we'll be able to pick up the first galaxies that nature gave us to look at, we hope. Probably within 100 million years of the expansion.
If you can tell our listeners a little bit about the construction of the telescope and how it's being made and where it's going to reside.
Okay. We're getting close to the end of the project, not too far from launch, although it's still a couple of years off. What we've done so far is build the telescope itself. That's to say the big collecting mirrors and the instrument package that collects the light and turns it into digits to send back to Earth. That's all built and tested and finished. And it was done through a partnership arrangement with Europe and Canada, as well as several gigantic aerospace contractors in the United States. So that part's finished, and it's beautiful, and mirrors are coated with gold, so they're the best possible infrared reflectors. And this part is passed through a test we did at Johnson Space Center last summer, passed through 50 inches of rain without getting any trouble, because it was inside the vacuum tank at the time. So we know that it can do basically almost perfect images as we had designed it to do. And what can it do? Well, just as a point of comparison, if you were a bumblebee hovering out there at the distance of the moon, we'd be able to see you two ways, both the reflected sunlight and the little bit of heat that you would transmit. That's so powerful that we think we'll see something nobody's expecting way out there. So all those things that I told you we want to see, well, we'll probably see them. But my great hope is that we'll see something else as well.
What's still needed to be done to complete the telescope?
What's left to do? We have to finish up the warm part of the observatory, the part with the electronics and the rocket engines and the big umbrella that we call a sunshade. And that we're working on now at Northrop Grumman Aerospace in Redondo Beach, California. That's a huge project in itself. When I say the sunshade, it sounds like, oh, that's just a big thing. Well, it's as big as a tennis court, and it's got 5 layers of thin plastic all metallized to keep the heat off the telescope. So that's the first of any kind that we've ever heard of where somebody needed that much umbrella in space.
Yeah, it must be pretty tricky to fit something like that in the size that you could put into a rocket. That sounds like a pretty big telescope.
Yeah, I didn't say, but the thing has to fold up. and it folds up very well, but it's a snug fit inside the rocket that we're getting. I should, by the way, mention that it's a European rocket because it's being contributed by Europe to our partnership. So that means when we are done finishing up the construction, we send it off to their launch site in South America.
Is there any other telescopes on the drawing board, anything that may be the replacement for the James Webb telescope?
Well, there's nothing that actually anybody is talking about that would be a replacement for the James Webb. So we want to make this one work. But following on after, there are lots of ideas for new things to do. We've already started something called the Wide Field Infrared Survey Telescope. And we have the mirrors given to us by the National Reconnaissance Office. And we're in the middle of designing it and doing pretty well with that. So that would have tremendous advantages for the studying the dark energy and the dark matter, and even for looking at planets out there. That one's coming along. The one after that, we haven't decided. There are four major possibilities that are under study, and we will be having a giant, what I call a science party in 2020, where astronomers from around the country will argue and make a choice about what they think is the most important thing to do next.
The decadal.
Yeah, that's our what we call the decadal survey. We do it every 10 years. And I even have an idea for something nobody's worked on before, which is to put up a star shade to orbit between a telescope on the ground and a distant star. And if you can do that, then you cast a shadow of the star on the telescope, and then you can look for the planets that are teeny tiny, very faint things nearby. So there's a hope that we'd be able to see solar systems everywhere and actually see the little dots orbiting around their stars.
I understand that the James Webb telescope will be more than 1 million miles from the Earth, too far for a servicing mission if something goes wrong, or if something fails on the telescope. Is that correct?
Well, the Webb telescope will be 1 million. It's a lot closer than the other planets are. The Sun is 100 times farther away than that, but this is still far away. It's still farther than we've ever sent a human being. So on the other hand, Congress says, well, we sure would be grateful if we could make a way so you could fix them if something goes wrong. So we certainly always think about that now. The technology is coming along. We've got bigger rockets coming. We've got space capsules suitable for longer trips coming along, private enterprise versions and NASA versions. Robotic servicing is coming along, too. So as time goes along, we'll be able to accomplish even more difficult things because we'll be able to fix them in case something goes wrong.
With the technology that we have today and looking at 3D printers and all kinds of technology that we have, it seems that there's nothing that's impossible for us to do.
I think that's right. Nothing's impossible. If it's not impossible, we should work on it.
I totally agree. I think the whole thing about exploration is that it's in our fiber to be explorers, and that's what we do as human beings.
Yes, and there's human advantages, human benefits to doing all this exploration, too. So eventually, things that you can't imagine turn out to be practical. 50 years ago, people were working on really precise atomic clocks for no reason except they wanted to know. And now, you're using them every time you drive anyplace with your GPS.
I could tell you myself, in the medical field, I've been in it for 44 years now, and when I first started this, there was no such thing as a CAT scanner or MRI unit. Many of these are spinoffs from the space program and other programs like it. And to think that when I first started, an ultrasound machine was about the size of a small refrigerator, and now they're the size, some of them are the size of laptops or even cell phones.
Yeah. By the way, the things that we astronomers use to focus our telescope through the turbulence of the Earth's atmosphere, or to focus our telescope after we launch it with a Webb telescope, the mathematics behind that is now in use in every eye doctor's office. So when you want to go get your eyes inspected or improved, we use the same math. It's wonderful to see.
It is wonderful, and to see that through our exploration, how we're helping humanity at the same time. It's great.
Yeah. So we're getting there. The miracles are yet to come.
Dr. Mather, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today. And if you'd like to come back and talk on the show again to talk more about these great things that are happening and what's going on with the James Webb and other things, we'd love to have you come back.
Well, thank you, Andy. It'll be a pleasure to do that.
Before I forget, is there any place that our listeners can go to learn more about the Cosmic Background Radiation Explorer and the James Webb Telescope?
Yeah, sure. The Wikipedia articles are pretty good. There's a book that I did. It's called The Very First Light with John Boslow that it's actually already getting old now, but it tells the story of building the Cosmic Background Explorer satellite and has a little chapter at the end about what happened after we got the call from Stockholm. Please come over and get a Nobel Prize. And then there are many, many things online now that we couldn't have told you about before, but NASA has information online about the James Webb Space Telescope. You just Google that, or any of our other telescopes. Google the Hubble Space Telescope. And the images that we have already made are available from Hubble. All the images that we get from the James Webb Space Telescope will be available online. So looking forward to having a lot of fun with that.
Dr. Mather, it was a real honor to have you with us today. Thanks for being on Cosmic Perspective Radio.
Well, thank you, Andy. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Cosmic Perspective Radio. The next airing of Cosmic Perspective Radio will be on the fourth Saturday of the month from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. If I don't see you by then, clear skies, everyone.